slender wad of paper. He knew at once that it was money, and that he would give it back. He held the money and watched his chance. Things were happening so fast that he felt he was not doing full justice to them. He was tired. Oh, if only he could go to sleep. If only this whole thing could be postponed for a few hours, until he had rested some. He felt that he would have been able to handle it then. Events were like the details of a tortured dream, happening without cause. At times, it seemed that he could not quite remember what had gone before, and what it was he was expecting to come. At the head of the stairs, the door opened, and he saw Britton. While the others were looking off, Bigger shoved the money back into the man's hand. The man looked at him, shook his head, and flicked his cigarette away and walked to the center of the floor.
"I'm sorry, boys," Britton said, "but the old man won't be able to see you till Tuesday."
Bigger thought quickly. That meant that Mr. Dalton was going to pay the money and was not going to call in the police.
"Tuesday? Oh, come on. Where is the girl?" "I'm sorry," said Britton.
"You're putting us in the position of having to print anything we can get about this case," said one of the men.
"You all know Mr. Dalton," Britton explained. "You wouldn't do that. For God's sake, give the man a chance. I can't tell you why now, but it's important. He'd do as much for you sometime."
"Is the girl missing?"
"I don't know."
"Is she here in the house?"
Britton hesitated.
"No, I don't think she is."
"When did she leave?"
"I don't know."
"When will she be back?"
"I can't say."
"Is this Erlone fellow telling the truth?" asked one of the men.
"He said that Mr. Dalton's trying to slander the Communist Party by having him arrested, and he says it's an attempt to break up his relationship with Miss Dalton."
"I don't know," Britton said. "Erlone was picked up and taken to police headquarters and questioned," the man continued. "He claimed that this boy here lied about his being in the home last night. Is that true?"
"Really, I can't say anything about that," Britton said.
"Did Mr. Dalton forbid Erlone to see Miss Dalton?"
"I don't know,"
Britton said, whipping out a handkerchief and wiping his forehead.
"Honest to God, boys, I can't tell you anything. You'll have to see the old man."
All eyes lifted at once. Mr. Dalton stood at the head of the stairs in the doorway, white-faced, holding a piece of paper in his fingers. Bigger knew at once that it was the kidnap note. What was going to happen now? All of the men talked at once, shouting questions, asking to take pictures.
"Where's Miss Dalton? Did you swear out a warrant for the arrest of Erlone? Were they engaged? Did you forbid her to see him? Did you object to his politics? Don't you want to make a statement, Mr. Dalton?"
Bigger saw Mr. Dalton lift his hand for silence, then walk slowly down the steps and stand near the men, just a few feet above them. They gathered closer, raising their silver bulbs.
"Do you wish to comment on what Erlone said about your chauffeur?"
"What did he say?"
Mr. Dalton asked.
"He said the chauffeur had been paid to lie about him."
"That's not true,"
Mr. Dalton said firmly. Bigger blinked as lightning shot past his eyes. He saw the men lowering the silver bulbs.
"Gentlemen," said Mr. Dalton, "please, give me just a moment. I do want to make a statement."
Mr. Dalton paused, his lips quivering. Bigger could see that he was very nervous.
"Gentlemen,"
Mr. Dalton said again,
"I want to make a statement, and I want you to take it carefully. The way you men handle this will mean life or death to someone, someone close to this family, to me, someone..."
Mr. Dalton's voice trailed off. The basement filled with murmurs of eagerness. Bigger heard the kidnap note crackling faintly in Mr. Dalton's fingers. Mr. Dalton's face was dead white, and his bloodshot eyes were deep set in his head above patches of dark-colored skin. The fire in the furnace was low, and the draft was but a whisper. Bigger saw Mr. Dalton's white hair glisten like molten silver from the pale sheen of the fire. Then suddenly, so suddenly that the men gasped, the door behind Mr. Dalton filled with a flowing white presence. It was Mrs. Dalton, her white eyes held wide and stony, her hands lifted sensitively upward toward her lips, her fingers long and white and wide apart. The basement was lit up with the white flash of a dozen silver bulbs. Ghost-like, Mrs. Dalton moved noiselessly down the steps until she came to Mr. Dalton's side, the big white cat following her. She stood with one hand lightly touching a banister, and the other held in midair. Mr. Dalton did not move or look around. He placed one of his hands over hers on the banister, covering it, and faced the men. Meanwhile, the big white cat bounded down the steps and leaped with one movement upon Bigger's shoulder and sat perched there. Bigger was still, feeling that the cat had given him away, had pointed him out as the murderer of Mary. He tried to lift the cat down, but its claws clutched his coat. The silver lightning flashed in his eyes, and he knew that the men had taken pictures of him with the cat poised upon his shoulder. He tugged at the cat once more and managed to get it down. It landed on its feet with a long whine, then began to rub itself against Bigger's legs. "God damn! Why can't that cat leave me alone?" He heard Mr. Dalton speaking. "Gentlemen, you may take pictures, but wait a moment. I've just phoned the police and asked that Mr. Erlon be released immediately. I want it known that I do not want to prefer charges against him. It is important that this be understood. I hope your papers will carry the story." Bigger wondered if this meant that suspicion was now pointing away from Jan. He wondered what would happen if he tried to leave the house. Were they watching him? "Further," Mr. Dalton went on, "I want to announce publicly that I apologize for his arrest and inconvenience." Mr. Dalton paused, wet his lips with his tongue, and looked down over the small knot of men whose hands were busy jotting his words down upon their white pads of paper. "And, gentlemen, I want to announce that Miss Dalton, our daughter, Miss Dalton..." Mr. Dalton's voice faltered. Behind him, a little to one side, stood Mrs. Dalton. She placed her white hand upon his arm. The men lifted their silver bulbs, and again lightning flashed in the red gloom of the basement. I want to announce," Mr. Dalton said in a quiet voice that carried throughout the room, though it was spoken in a tense whisper, "that Miss Dalton has been kidnapped."
"Kidnapped? Oh! When?"
"We think it happened last night," said Mr. Dalton.
"What are they asking?"
$10,000.
"Have you any idea who it is?"
"We know nothing."
"Have you had any word from her, Mr. Dalton?"
"No, not directly. We've had a letter from the kidnappers."
"Is that it there?"
"Yes, this is the letter."
"When did you get it?"
"Tonight."
"Through the mail?"
"No. Someone left it under our door."
"Are you going to pay the ransom?"
"Yes," said Mr. Dalton. "I'm going to pay. Listen, gentlemen, you can help me and perhaps save my daughter's life by saying in your stories that I'll pay as I've been instructed. And, too, what's most important, tell the kidnappers through your papers that I shall not call in the police.
Tell them I'll do everything they ask. Tell them to return our daughter. Tell them, for God's sake, not to kill her. That they will get what they want."
"Have you any idea, Mr. Dalton, who they are?"
"I have not."
"Can we see that letter?"
"I'm sorry, but you can't.
The instructions for the delivery of the money are here, and I have been cautioned not to make them public. But say in your papers that these instructions will be followed.
When was Miss Dalton last seen?
Sunday morning, about 2 o'clock.
Who saw her?
My chauffeur and my wife. Bigger stared straight before him, not allowing his eyes to move.
Please don't ask him any questions, said Mr. Dalton. I'm speaking for my whole family. I don't want a lot of crazy versions of this story going around. We want our daughter back. That's all that matters now. Tell her in the papers that we're doing all we can to get her back and that everything is forgiven. Tell her that we...
Again, his voice broke, and he could not go on.
Please, Mr. Dalton, begged one man. Just let us take one shot of that note.
No, no, I can't do that.
How is it signed?
Mr. Dalton looked straight before him. Bigger wondered if he would tell. He saw Mr. Dalton's lips moving silently, debating something.
Yes, I'll tell you how it's signed, said the old man, his hands trembling.
Mrs. Dalton's face turned slightly toward him, and her fingers gripped in his coat. Bigger knew that Mrs. Dalton was asking him silently if he had not better keep the signature of the note from the papers, and he knew, too, that Mr. Dalton seemed to have reasons of his own for wanting to tell. Maybe it was to let the Reds know that he had received their note.
Yes, Mr. Dalton said. It's signed Red, that's all.
Red?
Yes.
Do you know the identity?
No.
Have you any suspicions?
Beneath the signature is a scrawled emblem of the Communist Party, the hammer and the sickle, said Mr. Dalton. The men were silent. Bigger saw the astonishment on their faces. Several did not wait to hear more. They rushed out of the basement to telephone their stories in.
Do you think the Communists did it?
I don't know. I'm not positively blaming anybody. I'm only releasing this information to let the public and the kidnappers know that I've received this note. If they'll return my daughter, I'll ask no questions of anyone.
Was your daughter mixed up with those people, Mr. Dalton?
I know nothing about that.
Didn't you forbid your daughter to associate with this heirloom?
I hope this has nothing to do with that.
You think Erlon's mixed in this?
I don't know.
Why did you have him released?
I ordered his arrest before I received this note.
Do you feel that maybe he'll return the girl if he's out?
I don't know. I don't know if he's got our daughter. I only know that Mrs. Dalton and I want our daughter back.
Then why did you have Erlon released?
Because I have no charges to prefer against him, said Mr. Dalton stubbornly.
Mr. Dalton, hold the letter up and hold your hand out like you're making an appeal. Good. Now, put your hand out too, Mrs. Dalton, like that. Okay, hold it.
Bigger watched the silver bulbs flash again. Mr. and Mrs. Dalton were standing upon the steps. Mrs. Dalton in white, and Mr. Dalton with the letter in his hand and his eyes looking straight back to the rear wall of the basement. Bigger heard the soft whisper of the fire in the furnace and saw the men adjusting their cameras. Others were standing round, still scribbling nervously upon their pads of paper. The bulbs flashed again, and Bigger was startled to see that they were pointed in his direction. He wanted to duck his head or throw his hands in front of his face, but it was too late. They had enough pictures of him now to know him by sight in a crowd. A few more of the men left, and Mr. and Mrs. Dalton turned and walked slowly up the stairs and disappeared through the kitchen door, the big white cat following closely behind them. Bigger still stood with his back to the wall, watching, and trying to value every move in relation to himself and his chances of getting the money.
You suppose we can use Mr. Dalton's phone?
One of the men asked Britton.
Sure.
Britton led a group of them up the stairs into the kitchen. The three men who had come with Britton sat on the steps and stared gloomily at the floor. Soon, the men who had gone to phone their stories in came back. Bigger knew that they wanted to talk to him. Britton also came back and sat upon the steps.
Say, can't you give us any more dope on this?
One of the reporters asked Britton.
Mr. Dalton's told you everything,
Britton said.
This is a big story, said one of the men. Say, how did Mrs. Dalton take this?
She collapsed, said Britton.
For a while, nobody said anything. Then Bigger saw the men, one by one, turn and stare at him. He lowered his eyes. He knew that they were longing to ask him questions, and he did not want that. His eyes roved the room and saw the crumpled copy of the newspaper lying forgotten in a corner. He wanted ever so badly to read it. He would get at it the first opportunity and find out just what Jan had said. Presently, the men began to wander aimlessly about the basement, looking into corners, examining the shovel, the garbage pail, and the trunk. Bigger watched one man stand in front of the furnace. The man's hand reached out and opened the door. A feeble red glare lit the man's face as he stooped and looked inside at the bed of smoldering coals. Suppose he poked deeply into them. Suppose Mary's bones came into view. Bigger held his breath. But the man would not poke into that fire. Nobody suspected him. He was just a black clown. He breathed again as the man closed the door. The muscles of Bigger's face jerked violently, making him feel that he wanted to laugh. He turned his head aside and fought to control himself. He was full of hysteria.
Say, how about a look at the girl's room? Asked one of the men.
Sure, why not? Britton said.
All of the men followed Britton up the stairs, and Bigger was left alone. At once, his eyes went to the newspaper. He wanted to pick it up, but was afraid. He stepped to the back door and made sure that it was locked. Then he went to the top of the stairs and looked hurriedly into the kitchen. He saw no one. He bounded down the steps and snatched up the paper. He opened it and saw a line of heavy black type stretched across the top of the front page. Seek Hyde Park heiress missing from home since Saturday. Girl believed hiding out with communists. Police nab local red leader. Grilled on relationship with Mary Dalton. Authorities act on tip supplied by girl's father. And there was the picture of Jan in the center of page one. It was Jan, all right. Just like him. He turned to the story, reading. Did the foolish dream of solving the problem of human misery and poverty by dividing her father's real estate millions among the lowly force Mary Dalton to leave the palatial Hyde Park home of her parents, Mr. and Mrs. Henry G. Dalton, 4605 Drexel Boulevard, and take up life under an assumed name with her long-haired friends in the communist movement? This was the question that police sought to answer late tonight as they grilled Jan Erlon, executive secretary of the Labor Defenders, a communist front organization, in which it was said that Mary Dalton held a membership in defiance of her father's wishes. The story went on to say that Jan was being held for investigation at the 11th Street Police Station, and that Mary had been missing from her home since 8 o'clock Saturday night. It also mentioned that Mary had been in the company of Erlon until early Sunday morning, at a notorious Southside cafe in the Black Belt. That was all. He had expected more. He looked further. No, here was something else. It was a picture of Mary. It was so lifelike that it reminded him of how she had looked the first time he had seen her. He blinked his eyes. He was looking again in sweaty fear at her head lying upon the sticky newspapers with blood oozing outward toward the edges. Above the picture was a caption, In Dutch with Pa. Bigger lifted his eyes and looked at the furnace. It seemed impossible that she was there in the fire, burning. The story in the paper had not been as alarming as he had thought it would be. But as soon as they heard of Mary's being kidnapped, what would happen? He heard footsteps and dropped the paper back in the corner, and stood just as he had before, his back against the wall, his eyes vacant and sleepy. The door opened, and the men came down the steps, talking in low, excited tones. Again, Bigger noticed that they were watching him. Britton also came back.
"Say, why can't we talk to this boy?" one demanded. "There's nothing he can tell you," Britton said.
"But he can tell us what he saw. After all, he drove the car last night."
"Okay with me," Britton said. "But Mr. Dalton's told you everything."
One of the men walked over to Bigger.
"Say, Mike, you think this Erlone fella did this?"
"My name ain't Mike," Bigger said resentfully.
"Oh, I don't mean no harm," the man said. "But do you think he did it?" "Answer his questions, Bigger," Britton said.
Bigger was sorry he had taken offense. He could not afford to get angry now. And he had no need to be angry. Why should he be angry with a lot of fools? They were looking for the girl, and the girl was 10 feet from them, burning. He had killed her, and they did not know it. He would let them call him Mike.
"I don't know, sir," he said.
"Come on, tell us what happened."
"I only work here, sir," Bigger said.
"Don't be afraid, nobody's going to hurt you."
"Mr. Britton can tell you," Bigger said. The men shook their heads and walked away.
"Good God, Britton," said one of the men. "All we've got in this kidnapping is that a letter was found, heirlooms to be released, the letter was signed by Red, and there was a hammer and sickle emblem on it. That doesn't make sense. Give us some more details." "Listen, you guys," Britton said. "Give the old man a chance. He's trying to get his daughter back alive. He's giving you a big story. Now wait. Tell us straight now. When was that girl last seen?"
Bigger listened to Britton tell the story all over again. He listened carefully to every word Britton said and to the tone of voice in which the men asked their questions, for he wanted to know if any of them suspected him. But they did not. All of their questions pointed to Jan.
"But Britton," asked one of the men, "why did the old man want this Erlone released?" "Figure it out for yourself," Britton said. "Then he thinks Erlone had something to do with the snatching of his daughter and wanted him out so he could give her back?" "I don't know," Britton said. "Oh, come on, Britton." "Use your imagination," Britton said.
Two more of the men buttoned their coats, pulled their hats low over their eyes, and left. Bigger knew that they were going to phone in more information to their papers. They were going to tell about Jan's trying to convert him to communism. The communist literature Jan had given him. The rum. The half-packed trunk being taken down to the station. And lastly, about the kidnap note and the demand for $10,000. The men looked round the basement with flashlights. Bigger still leaned against the wall. Britton sat on the steps. The fire whispered in the furnace. Bigger knew that soon he would have to clean the ashes out, for the fire was not burning as hotly as it should. He would do that as soon as some of the excitement died down and all of the men left.
"It's pretty bad, huh, Bigger?" Britton asked.
"Yes, sir."
"I'd bet $1,000,000 that this is Jan's smart idea."
Bigger said nothing. He was limp all over. He was standing up here against this wall by some strength not his own. Hours passed. He had given up trying to exert himself anymore. He could no longer call up any energy. So he just forgot it and found himself coasting along. It was getting a little chilly. The fire was dying. The draft could scarcely be heard. Then the basement door burst open suddenly, and one of the men who had gone to telephone came in, his mouth open, his face wet and red from the snow.
"Say," he called.
"Yeah?"
"What is it?"
"My city editor just told me that Erlone fellow won't leave jail."
For a moment, the strangeness of the news made them all stare silently. Bigger roused himself and tried to make out just what it meant. Then someone asked the question he longed to ask.
"Won't leave? What you mean?"
"Well, this Erlone refused to go when they told him that Mr. Dalton had requested his release. It seems he had got wind of the kidnapping and said that he didn't want to go out."
"That means he's guilty," said Britton. "He doesn't want to leave jail because he knows they'll shadow him and find out where the girl is, see? He's scared."
"What else?"
"Well, this Erlone says he's got a dozen people to swear that he did not come here last night."
Bigger's body stiffened, and he leaned forward slightly.
"That's a lie," Britton said. "This boy here saw him."
"Is that right, boy?"
Bigger hesitated. He suspected a trap. But if Jan really had an alibi, then he had to talk. He had to steer them away from himself.
"Yes, sir?"
"Well, somebody's lying. That Erlone fella says that he can prove it."
"Prove hell," Britton said.
"He's just got some of his red friends to lie for him, that's all."
"But what in hell's the good of his not wanting to leave jail?" asked one of the men.
"He says if he stays in, they can't possibly say he's mixed up in this kidnapping business. He said this boy's lying. He claims they told him to say these things in order to blacken his name and reputation. He swears the family knows where the girl is, and that this thing is a stunt to raise a cry against the Reds."
The men gathered round Bigger.
"Say, boy, come on with the dope now. Was that guy really here last night?"
"Yes, sir. He was here all right."
"You saw him?"
"Yes, sir."
"Where?"
"I drove him and Miss Dalton up here in the car. We went upstairs together to get the trunk."
"And you left him here?"
"Yes, sir."
Bigger's heart was pounding, but he tried to keep his face and voice under control. He did not want to seem unduly excited over these new developments. He was wondering if Jan could really prove that he had not been here last night. And he was thinking the question in his own mind when he heard someone ask,
"Who has this Erlone got to prove he was not here last night?"
"He says he met some friend of his when he got on the streetcar last night, and he says he went to a party after he left Miss Dalton at 2:30.
"Where was the party?"
"Somewhere on the north side."
"Say, if what he says is true, then there's something fishy here."
"Nah," said Britton. "I'll bet he went to his pals, the ones he planned all of this with."
"Sure. Why wouldn't they alibi for him?"
"So you really think he did it?"
"Hell yes," Britton said. "These Reds will do anything and they stick together. Sure, he's got an alibi. Why shouldn't he have one? He's got enough pals working for him. His wanting to stay in jail's nothing but a dodge. But he's not so smart. He thinks that his gag'll work and leave him free of suspicion, but it won't."
The talk stopped abruptly as the door at the head of the stairs opened. Peggy's head came through.
"You gentlemen want some coffee?" she asked.
"Sure, atta gal."
"I'll bring some down in just a minute," she said, closing the door.
"Who is she?"
"Mrs. Dalton's cook and housekeeper," Britton said.
"She know anything about all this?"
"Nah."
Again, the men turned to Bigger. He felt this time he had to say something more to them. Jan was saying that he was lying, and he had to wipe out doubt in their minds. They would think that he knew more than he was telling if he did not talk. After all, their attitude toward him so far made him feel that they did not consider him as being mixed up in the kidnapping. He was just another black, ignorant Negro to them. The main thing was to keep their minds turned in another direction, Jan's direction, or that of Jan's friends.
"Say," one of the men asked, coming close to him and placing a foot upon the edge of the trunk, "did this Erlone fellow talk to you about communism?"
Yes, sir.
Oh, Britton exclaimed. What? I forgot. Let me show you fellas the stuff he gave the boy to read.
Britton stood up, his face flushed with eagerness. He ran his hands into his pocket and pulled forth the batch of pamphlets that Jan had given bigger and held them up for all to see. The men again got their bulbs and flashed their lightning to take pictures of the pamphlets. Bigger could hear their hard breathing. He knew that they were excited. When they finished, they turned to him again.
Say, boy, was this guy drunk?
Yes, sir.
And the girl, too?
Yes, sir.
He took the girl upstairs when they got here?
Yes, sir.
Say, boy, what do you think of public ownership? Do you think the government ought to build houses for people to live in?
Bigger blinked. Sir?
Well, what do you think of private property?
I don't own any property, no, sir, Bigger said.
He's a dumb cluck. He doesn't know anything, one of the men whispered in a voice loud enough for Bigger to hear.
There was silence. Bigger leaned against the wall, hoping that this would satisfy them for a time at least. The draft could not be heard in the furnace now at all. The door opened again, and Peggy came into view, carrying a pot of coffee in one hand and a folding card table in the other. One of the men went up the steps and met her, took the table, opened it, and placed it for her. She set the pot upon it. Bigger saw a thin spout of steam jutting from the pot and smelt the good scent of coffee. He wanted some, but he knew that he should not ask with the white men waiting to drink.
Thank you, sirs, Peggy mumbled, looking humbly round at the strange faces of the men. I'll get the sugar and cream in some cups. Say, boy, Britton said, tell the men how Jan made you eat with him. Yeah, tell us about it. Is it true?
Yes, sir.
You didn't want to eat with him, did you?
No, sir.
Did you ever eat with white people before?
No, sir.
Did this guy, Erlone, say anything to you about white women?
Oh, no, sir.
How did you feel eating with him and Miss Dalton?
I don't know, sir. It was my job.
You didn't feel just right, did you?
Well, sir, they told me to eat and I ate. It was my job.
In other words, you felt you had to eat or lose your job?
Yes, sir, said Bigger, feeling that this ought to place him in the light of a helpless, bewildered man.
Good God, said one of the men. What a story, don't you see? These Negroes want to be left alone, and these Reds are forcing them to live with them, see? Every wire in the country will carry it. This is better than Loeb and Leopold, said one. Say, I'm slanting this to the primitive Negro who doesn't want to be disturbed by white civilization. A swell idea. Say, is this Erlone really a citizen? That's an angle. Mention his foreign-sounding name. Is he Jewish? I don't know. This is good enough as it is. You can't have everything you want. It's classic.
It's a natural. Then, before Bigger knew it, the men had their bulbs in their hands again, aiming at him. He hung his head slowly, slowly, so as not to let them know that he was trying to dodge them.
Hold up a little, boy. Stand straight. Look over this way. Now that's it.
Yes. The police would certainly have enough pictures of him. He thought it rather bitterly, smiling a smile that did not reach his lips or eyes.
This ends Disc 7. Native Son, Disc 8.
Peggy came back with her arms full of cups, saucers, spoons, a jar of cream, and a bowl of sugar.
Here it is, sirs. Help yourselves.
She turned to Bigger.
There's not enough heat upstairs.
You'd better clean those ashes out and make a better fire.
Yes'm.
Clean the fire out. Good God. Not now,
not with the men standing around. He did not move from his place beside the wall. He watched Peggy walk back up the stairs and close the door behind her. Well, he had to do something. Peggy had spoken to him in the presence of these men, and for him not to obey would seem odd. And even if they did not say anything about it, Peggy herself would soon come back and ask about the fire. Yes, he had to do something. He walked to the door of the furnace and opened it. The low bed of fire was red hot, but he could tell from the weak blast of heat upon his face that it was not as hot as it ought to be, not as hot as it had been when he had shoved Mary in. He was trying to make his tired brain work fast. What could he do to avoid bothering with the ashes? He stooped and opened the lower door. The ashes, white and gray, were piled almost level with the lower grate. No air could get through. Maybe he could sift the ashes down more and make that do until the men left. He would try it. He caught hold of the handle and worked it to and fro, seeing white ashes and red embers falling into the bottom of the furnace. Behind him, he could hear the men's talk and the tinkle of their spoons against the cups. Well, there. He had gotten some of the ashes down out of the stove, but they choked the lower bin and still no air could get through. He would put some coal in. He shut the doors of the furnace and pulled the lever for coal. There was the same loud rattle of coal against the tin sides of the chute. The interior of the furnace grew black with coal, but the draft did not roar and the coal did not blaze. God damn. He stood up and looked helplessly into the furnace. Ought he to try to slip out of here and leave this whole foolish thing right now? No. There was no use of being scared. He had a chance to get that money. Put more coal in. It would burn after a while. He pulled the lever for still more coal. Inside the furnace, he saw the coal beginning to smoke. There were faint wisps of white smoke at first. Then the smoke grew dark, bulging out. Bigger's eyes smarted, watered. He coughed. The smoke was rolling from the furnace now in heavy, billowing gray clouds, filling the basement. Bigger backed away, catching a lungful of smoke. He bent over, coughing. He heard the men coughing. He had to do something about those ashes, and quickly. With his hand stretched before him, he groped in the corner for the shovel, found it, and opened the lower door of the furnace. The smoke surged out, thick and acrid. God damn.
You'd better do something about those ashes, boy, one of the men called. That fire can't get any air, Bigger.
It was Britton's voice.
Yes, sir, Bigger mumbled.
He could scarcely see. He stood still, his eyes closed and stinging, his lungs heaving, trying to expel the smoke. He held onto the shovel, wanting to move, to do something, but he did not know what.
Say, you, get some of those ashes out of there. What are you trying to do, smother us?
I'm getting them out, Bigger mumbled, not moving from where he stood.
He heard a cup smash on the concrete floor, and a man cursed.
I can't see. The smoke's got my eyes.
Bigger heard someone near him. Then someone was tugging at the shovel in his hands. He held on to it desperately, not wanting to let it go, feeling that if he did so, he was surrendering his secret, his life.
Here, give me that shovel. I'll help you,
a man coughed.
No, sir, I can do it, Bigger said.
Come on, let go.
His fingers loosened about the shovel.
Yes, sir,
he said, not knowing what else to say. Through the clouds of smoke, he heard the man clanging the shovel round inside of the ash bin. He coughed and stepped back, his eyes blazing, as though fire had leaped into them. Behind him, the other men were coughing. He opened his eyes and strained to see what was happening. He felt that there was suspended just above his head a huge weight that would soon fall and crush him. His body,
despite the smoke and his burning eyes and heaving chest, was Flex taut. He wanted to lunge at the man and take the shovel from him, slam him across the head with it, and bolt from the basement. But he stood still, hearing the babble of voices and the clanging of the shovel against iron. He knew that the man was digging frantically at the ashes in the bin, trying to clean out as much as possible so that air could pass up through the grates, pipes, chimney, and out into the night. He heard the man yell, "Open that door! I'm choking!" There was a scuffle of feet. Bigger felt the icy wind of the night sweep over him, and he discovered that he was wet with sweat. Somehow, something had happened, and now things were out of his hands. He was nervously poised, waiting for what the new flow of events would bring. The smoke drifted past him toward the open door. The room was clearing. The smoke thinned to a gray pall. He heard the man grunting and saw him bend over, digging at the ashes in the bin. He wanted to go to him and ask for the shovel. He wanted to say that he could take care of it now, but he did not move. He felt that he had let things slip through his hands to such an extent that he could not get at them again. Then he heard the draft. This time, a long, low sucking of air that grew gradually to a drone, then a roar. The air passage was clear.
"There was a hell of a lot of ashes in there, boy," the man gasped. "You shouldn't let it get that way."
"Yes, sir," Bigger whispered. The draft roared loud now. The air passage was completely clear.
"Shut that door, boy. It's cold in here," one of the men called.
He wanted to go to the door and keep right on out of it and shut it behind him. But he did not move. One of the men closed it, and Bigger felt the cold air fall away from his wet body. He looked round. The men were still standing about the table, red-eyed, sipping coffee.
"What's the matter, boy?" one of them asked.
"Nothing," Bigger said. The man with the shovel stood in front of the furnace and looked down into the ashes strewn over the floor. "What's he doing?" Bigger wondered. He saw the man stoop and poke the shovel into the ashes. "What's he looking at?" Bigger's muscles twitched. He wanted to run to the man's side and see what it was he was looking at. He had in his mind an image of Mary's head lying there, bloody and unburnt, before the man's eyes. Suddenly, the man straightened, only to stoop again, as though unable to decide if the evidence of his eyes was true. Bigger edged forward, his lungs not taking in or letting out air. He himself was a huge furnace now, through which no air could go. And the fear that surged into his stomach, filling him, choking him, was like the fumes of smoke that had belched from the ash bin.
"Say," the man called. His voice sounded tentative, dubious.
"What?"
one man at the table answered.
"Come here. Look."
The man's voice was low, excited, tense. But what it lacked in volume was more than made up for in the breathless manner in which he spoke. The words had rolled without effort from his lips. The men set their cups down and ran to the pile of ashes. Bigger, doubtful and uncertain, paused as the men ran past him.
"What is it? What's the matter?"
Bigger tiptoed and looked over their shoulders. He did not know how he got strength enough to go and look. He just found himself walking and then found himself standing and peering over the men's shoulders. He saw a pile of scattered ashes. Nothing else. But there must be something. Or why would the men be looking?
"What is it?"
"See? This."
"What?"
"Look. It's..."
The man's voice trailed off, and he stooped again and poked the shovel deeper. Bigger saw come into full view on the surface of the ashes several small pieces of white bone. Instantly, his whole body was wrapped in a sheet of fear.
It's bone.
Ah, one of the men said. That's just some garbage they're burning.
No, wait. Let's see that.
Torment, come here. You studied medicine once. The man called Torment reached out his foot and kicked an oblong bone from the ashes. It slid a few inches over the concrete floor.
My God, it's from a body.
And look, here's something. One of them stooped and picked up a bit of round metal and held it close to his eyes.
It's an earring.
There was silence. Bigger stared without a thought or an image in his mind. There was just the old feeling. The feeling that he had had all his life. He was black and had done wrong. White men were looking at something with which they would soon accuse him. It was the old feeling, hard and constant again now, of wanting to grab something and clutch it in his hands and swing it into someone's face. He knew. They were looking at the bones of Mary's body. Without its making a clear picture in his mind, he understood how it had happened. Some of the bones had not burnt and had fallen into the lower bin when he had worked the handle to sift the ashes. The white man had poked in the shovel to clear the air passage and had raked them out. And now, there they lay, tiny oblong pieces of white bone, cushioned in gray ashes. He could not stay here now. At any moment, they would begin to suspect him. They would hold him. They would not let him go, even if they were not certain whether he had done it or not. And Jan was still in jail, swearing that he had an alibi. They would know that Mary was dead. They had stumbled upon the white bones of her body. They would be looking for the murderer. The men were silent, bent over, poking into the pile of gray ashes. Bigger saw the hatchet blade come into view.
God!
The whole world was tumbling down. Quickly, Bigger's eyes looked at their bent backs. They were not watching him. The red glare of the fire lit their faces, and the draft of the furnace drummed. Yes, he would go. Now. He tiptoed to the rear of the furnace and stopped, listening. The men were whispering in tense tones of horror.
It's the girl. Good God. Who do you suppose did it?
Bigger tiptoed up the steps, one at a time, hoping that the roar of the furnace and the men's voices and the scraping of the shovel would drown out the creaking sounds his feet made. He reached the top of the steps and breathed deeply, his lungs aching from holding themselves full of air so long. He stole to the door of his room and opened it, and went in and pulled on the light. He turned to the window and put his hands under the upper ledge and lifted. He felt a cold rush of air laden with snow. He heard muffled shouts downstairs, and the inside of his stomach glowed white hot. He ran to the door and locked it, and then turned out the light. He groped to the window and climbed into it, feeling again the chilling blast of snowy wind. With his feet upon the bottom ledge, his legs bent under him, his sweaty body shaken by wind, he looked into the snow and tried to see the ground below, but he could not. Then he leaped, headlong, sensing his body twisting in the icy air as he hurtled. His eyes were shut, and his hands were clenched as his body turned, sailing through the snow. He was in the air a moment, then he hit. It seemed at first that he hit softly, but the shock of it went through him, up his back to his head, and he lay buried in a cold pile of snow, dazed. Snow was in his mouth, eyes, ears. Snow was seeping down his back. His hands were wet and cold. Then he felt all of the muscles of his body contract violently, caught in a spasm of reflex action, and at the same time he felt his groin laved with warm water. It was his urine. He had not been able to control the muscles of his hot body against the chilled assault of the wet snow all over his skin. He lifted his head, blinking his eyes, and looked above him. He sneezed. He was himself now. He struggled against the snow, pushing it away from him. He got to his feet one at a time and pulled himself out. He walked, then tried to run, but he felt too weak. He went down Drexel Boulevard, not knowing just where he was heading, but knowing that he had to get out of this white neighborhood. He avoided the car line, turned down dark streets, walking more rapidly now, his eyes before him, but turning, now and then, to look behind. Yes. He would have to tell Bessie not to go to that house. It was all over. He had to save himself. But it was familiar, this running away. All his life he had been knowing that sooner or later, something like this would come to him. And now, here it was. He had always felt outside of this white world, and now it was true. It made things simple. He felt in his shirt. Yes, the gun was still there. He might have to use it. He would shoot before he would let them take him. It meant death either way, and he would die shooting every slug he had. He came to Cottage Grove Avenue and walked southward. He could not make any plans until he got to Bessie's and got the money. He tried to shut out of his mind the fear of being caught. He lowered his head against the driving snow and tramped through the icy streets with clenched fists. Although his hands were almost frozen, he did not want to put them in his pockets, for that would have made him feel that he would not have been ready to defend himself were the police to accost him suddenly. He went on past street lamps covered with thick coatings of snow, gleaming like huge frosted moons above his head. His face ached from the sub-zero cold, and the wind cut into his wet body like a long, sharp knife, going to the heart of him with pain. He was in sight of 47th Street now. He saw, through a gauze-like curtain of snow, a boy standing under an awning selling papers. He pulled his cap visor lower and slipped into a doorway to wait for a car. Back of the newsboy was a stack of papers piled high upon a newsstand. He wanted to see the tall black headline, but the driving snow would not let him. The papers ought to be full of him now. It did not seem strange that they should be. For all his life, he had felt that things had been happening to him that should have gone into them. But only after he had acted upon feelings which he had had for years would the papers carry the story, his story. He felt that they had not wanted to print it as long as it had remained buried and burning in his own heart. But now that he had thrown it out, thrown it at those who made him live as they wanted, the papers were printing it. He fished 3 cents out of his pocket. He went over to the boy with averted face. Tribune. He took the paper into a doorway. His eyes swept the streets above the top of it. Then he read in tall black type, "Millionaire heiress kidnapped. Abductors demand $10,000 in ransom note. Dalton family ask release of communist suspect." Yes. They had it now. Soon they would have the story of her death, of the reporters finding her bones in the furnace, of her head being cut off, of his running away during the excitement. He looked up, hearing the approach of a car. When it heaved into sight, he saw that it was almost empty of passengers. Good. He ran into the street and reached the steps just as the last man got on. He paid his fare, watching to see if the conductor was noticing him, then went through the car, watching to see if any face was turned to him. He stood on the front platform, back of the motorman. if anything happened, he could get off quickly here. The car started, and he opened the paper again, reading. A servant's discovery early yesterday evening of a crudely penciled ransom note demanding $10,000 for the return of Mary Dalton, missing Chicago heiress, and the Dalton family's sudden demand for the release of Jan Erlon, communist leader, held in connection with the girl's disappearance, were the startling developments in a case which is baffling local and state police. The note bearing the signature of Red and the famed hammer and sickle emblem of the Communist Party was found sticking under the door by Peggy O'Flaherty, a cook and housekeeper in the Henry Dalton residence in Hyde Park. Bigger read a long stretch of type in which was described the questioning of a Negro chauffeur, the half-packed trunk, the communist pamphlets, drunken sexual orgies, the frantic parents, and the radical's contradictory story. Bigger's eyes skimmed the words, clandestine meetings offered opportunities for abduction. Police asked not to interfere in case. Anxious family trying to contact kidnappers. And it was conjectured that perhaps the family had information to the effect that Erlon knew of the whereabouts of Miss Dalton, and certain police officials assigned that as the motive behind the family's request for the radical's release, reiterating that police had framed him as part of a drive to oust communists from Chicago. Erlon demanded that the charges upon which he had been originally held be made public. Failing to obtain a satisfactory answer, he refused to leave jail, whereupon police again remanded him to his cell upon a charge of disorderly conduct. Bigger lifted his eyes and looked about. No one was watching him. His hand was shaking with excitement. The car moved lumberingly through the snow, and he saw that he was near 50th Street. He stepped to the door and said, "Out." The car stopped, and he swung off into the driving snow. He was almost in front of Bessie's now. He looked up to her window. It was dark. The thought that she might not be in her room, but out drinking with friends, made him angry. He went into the vestibule. A dim light glowed, and his body was thankful for the meager warmth. He could finish reading the paper now. He unfolded it. Then, for the first time, he saw his picture. It was down in the lower left-hand corner of page 2. Above it he read, "Reds tried to snare him." It was a small picture, and his name was under it. He looked solemn and black, and his eyes gazed straight, and the white cat sat perched upon his right shoulder, its big round black eyes twin pools of secret guilt. And oh, here was a picture of Mr. and Mrs. Dalton standing upon the basement steps. That the image of Mr. and Mrs. Dalton, which he had seen but 2 hours ago, should be seen again so soon, made him feel that this whole vague white world which could do things this quickly was more than a match for him. That soon it would track him down and have it out with him. The white-haired old man and the white-haired old woman standing on the steps with their arms stretched forth pleadingly were a powerful symbol of helpless suffering and would stir up a lot of hate against him when it was found out that a Negro had killed Mary. Bigger's lips tightened. There was no chance of his getting that money now. They had found Mary, and would stop at nothing to get the one who had killed her. There would be 1,000 white policemen on the south side searching for him, or any black man who looked like him. He pressed the bell and waited for the buzzer to ring. Was she there? Again he pressed the bell, holding his finger hard upon it until the door buzzed. He bounded up the steps, sucking his breath in sharply at each lift of his knees. When he reached the second landing, he was breathing so hard that he stopped, closed his eyes, and let his chest heave itself to stillness. He glanced up and saw Bessie staring sleepily at him through the half-open door. He went in and stood for a moment in the darkness. "Turn on a light," he said.
"Bigger, what's happened?"
"Turn on the light." She said nothing and did not move. He groped forward, sweeping the air with his open palm for the cord. He found it and jerked on the light. Then he whirled and looked about him, expecting to see someone lurking in the corners of the room.
"What's happened?"
She came forward and touched his clothes.
"You're wet."
"It's all off," he said.
"I don't have to do it?"
she asked eagerly. "Yes." She was thinking only of herself now. He was alone.
"Bigger, tell me what happened."
"They know all about it. They'll be after me soon." Her eyes were too filled with fear to cry. He walked about aimlessly, and his shoes left rings of dirty water on the wooden floor.
"Tell me, Bigger, please."
She was wanting the word that would free her of this nightmare, but he would not give it to her. No. Let her be with him. Let somebody be with him now. She caught hold of his coat, and he felt her body trembling.
"Will they come for me too, Bigger? I didn't want to do it."
Yes. He would let her know. Let her know everything. But let her know it in a way that would bind her to him, at least a little longer. He did not want to be alone now. "They found a girl," he said.
"What we going to do, Bigger? Look what you done to me."
She began to cry. "Oh, come on, kid."
"You really killed her?"
"She's dead," he said. "They found her." She ran to the bed, fell upon it, and sobbed. With her mouth all twisted and her eyes wet, she asked in gasps,
You didn't send the letter?"
"Yeah."
"Bigger,"
she whimpered. "They ain't no help for it now."
"Oh, Lord, they'll come for me. They'll know you did it. And they'll go to your home and talk to your ma and brother and everybody. They'll come for me now, sure."
That was true. There was no way for her but to come with him. If she stayed here, they would come to her, and she would simply lie in the bed and sob out everything. She would not be able to help it. And what she would tell them about him, his habits, his life, would help them to track him down. "You got the money?"
"It's in my dress pocket."
"How much is it?"
$90.
"Well, what you planning to do?" he asked.
"I wish I could kill myself."
"Ain't no use talking that way."
"There ain't no way else to talk."
It was a shot in the dark, but he decided to try it. "If you don't act better than this, I'll just leave."
No, Bigger,"
she cried, rising and running to him. "Well, snap out of it," he said, backing to a chair. He sat down and felt how tired he was. Some strength he did not know he possessed had enabled him to run away, to stand here and talk with her. But now he felt that he would not have strength enough to run, even if the police should suddenly burst into the room.
"You hurt?"
she asked, catching hold of his shoulder. He leaned forward in the chair and rested his face in the palms of his hands.
"Bigger, what's the matter?"
"I'm tired and awful sleepy," he sighed.
"Let me fix you something to eat."
"I need a drink."
No whiskey. You need some hot milk."
He waited, hearing her move about. It seemed that his body had turned to a piece of lead that was cold and heavy and wet and aching. Bessie switched on her electric stove, emptied a bottle of milk into a pan, and set it upon the glowing red circle. She came back to him and placed her hands upon his shoulders, her eyes wet with fresh tears.
"I'm scared, Bigger."
"You can't be scared now."
"You oughtn't have killed her, honey."
"I didn't mean to. I couldn't help it, I swear."
"What happened? You never told me."
Oh, hell. I was in a room.
Her room?
Yeah, she was drunk. She passed out. I took her there.
What'd she do?
She... Nothing. She didn't do anything. Her ma came in. She's blind.
The girl?
Nah, her ma. I didn't want her to find me there. Well, the girl was trying to say something, and I was scared. I just put the edge of the pillow in her mouth, and I didn't mean to kill her. I just pulled the pillow over her face, and she died. Her ma came into the room, and the girl was trying to say something. And her ma had her hand stretched out like this, see? I was scared she was going to touch me. I just sort of pushed the pillow hard over the girl's face to keep her from yelling. Her ma didn't touch me. I got out of the way. But when she left, I went to the bed, and the girl... She was dead. That was all. She was dead. I didn't mean.
You didn't plan to kill her?
No, I swear I didn't. But what's the use? Nobody will believe me.
Honey, don't you see?
What?
They'll say...
Bessie cried again. He caught her face in his hands. He was concerned. He wanted to see this thing through her eyes at that moment.
What?
They'll say you raped her.
Bigger stared. He had entirely forgotten the moment when he had carried Mary up the stairs. So deeply had he pushed it all back down into him that it was not until now that its real meaning came back. They would say he had raped her, and there would be no way to prove that he had not. That fact had not assumed importance in his eyes until now. He stood up, his jaws hardening. Had he raped her? Yes, he had raped her. Every time he felt as he had felt that night, he raped. But rape was not what one did to women. Rape was what one felt when one's back was against a wall, and one had to strike out, whether one wanted to or not, to keep the pack from killing one. He committed rape every time he looked into a white face. He was a long, taut piece of rubber which 1,000 white hands had stretched to the snapping point, and when he snapped, it was rape. But it was rape when he cried out in hate deep in his heart, as he felt the strain of living day by day. That, too, was rape.
They found her?
Bessie asked.
Huh?
They found her?
Yeah, her bones.
Bones?
Oh, Bessie, I didn't know what to do. I put her in the furnace.
Bessie flung her face to his wet coat and wailed violently.
Bigger.
Huh?
What we going to do?
I don't know.
They'll be looking for us.
They got my picture.
Where can we hide?
We can stay in some of them old houses for a while.
But they might find us there.
There's plenty of them. It'll be like hiding in the jungle.
The milk on the stove boiled over. Bessie rose, her lips still twisted with sobs, and turned off the electric switch. She poured out a glass of milk and brought it to him. He sipped it, slowly, then set the glass aside and leaned over again. They were silent. Bessie gave him the glass once more, and he drank it down, then another glass. He stood up, his legs and entire body feeling heavy and sleepy. Get your clothes on, and get them blankets and quilts. We got to get out of here. She went to the bed and rolled the covers back, rolling the pillows with them. As she worked, Bigger went to her and put his hands on her shoulders.
Where's the bottle? She got it from her purse and gave it to him. He drank a long swallow, and she put it back. Hurry up, he said. She sobbed softly as she worked, pausing now and then to wipe tears from her eyes. Bigger stood in the middle of the floor, thinking. Maybe they're searching at home now. Maybe they're talking to Ma and Vera and Buddy. He crossed the floor and twitched back the curtains and looked out. The streets were white and empty. He turned and saw Bessie bent motionless over the pile of bedclothing. Come on, we got to get out of here.
I don't care what happens.
Come on, you can't act like that. What could he do with her? She would be a dangerous burden. It would be impossible to take her if she were going to act like this. And yet he could not leave her here. Coldly, he knew that he had to take her with him, and then, at some future time, settle things with her. Settle them in a way that would not leave him in any danger. He thought of it calmly, as if the decision were being handed down to him by some logic not his own, over which he had no control, but which he had to obey. You want me to leave you here?
No, Bigger.
Well, come on. Get your hat and coat. She was facing him. Then she sank to her knees.
Oh, Lord,
she moaned.
What's the use of running? They'll catch us anywhere. I should have known this would happen.
She clenched her hands in front of her and rocked to and fro with her eyes closed upon gushing tears.
All my life's been full of hard trouble. If I wasn't hungry, I was sick. And if I wasn't sick, I was in trouble. I ain't never bothered nobody. I just worked hard every day as long as I can remember, till I was tired enough to drop. Then I had to get drunk to forget it. I had to get drunk to sleep. That's all I ever did. And now I'm in this. They looking for me, and when they catch me, they'll kill me.
She bent her head to the floor.
God only knows why I ever let you treat me this way. I wish to God I never seen you. I wish one of us had died before we was born. God knows I do. All you ever caused me was trouble, just plain black trouble. All you ever did since we've been knowing each other was to get me drunk so you could have me. That was all. I see it now. I ain't drunk now. I see everything you ever did to me. I didn't want to see it before. I was too busy thinking about how good I felt when I was with you. I thought I was happy, but deep down in me, I knew I wasn't. But you got me in this murder, and I see it all now. I've been a fool, just a blind, dumb, black, drunk fool. Now I got to run away, and I know deep down in your heart you really don't care.
She stopped, choked. He had not listened to what she had said. Her words had made leap to consciousness in him a thousand details of her life, which he had long known, and they made him see that she was in no condition to be taken along, and at the same time in no condition to be left behind. It was not with anger or regret that he thought this, but as a man seeing what he must do to save himself, and feeling resolved to do it. Come on, Bessie. We can't stay here like this. He stooped, and with one hand caught hold of her arm, and with the other he lifted the bundle of bedclothes. He dragged her across the threshold and pulled the door after him. He went down the steps. She came stumbling behind, whimpering. When he had reached the vestibule, he got his gun from inside his shirt and put it in the pocket of his coat. He might have to use it any minute now. The moment he stepped out of that door, he would have his life in his hands. Whatever happened now depended upon him, and when he felt it that way, some of his fear left. It was simple again. He opened the door, and an icy blast of wind struck his face. He drew back and turned to Bessie. Where's the bottle? She held out her purse. He got the bottle and took a deep drink,
Here, he said. You better take one.
She drank and put the bottle back into her purse. They went into the snow, over the frozen streets, through the sweeping wind. Once she stopped and began to cry. He grabbed her arm.
Shut up now. Come on.
They stopped in front of a tall, snow-covered building whose many windows gaped blackly, like the eye sockets of empty skulls. He took the purse from her and got the flashlight. He clutched her arm and pulled her up the steps to the front door. It was half ajar. He put his shoulder to it and gave a stout shove. It yielded grudgingly. It was black inside, and the feeble glow of the flashlight did not help much. A sharp scent of rot floated to him, and he heard the scurrying of quick, dry feet over the wooden floor. Bessie sucked in her breath deeply, about to scream, but Bigger gripped her arm so hard that she bent halfway over and moaned. As he went up the steps, there came frequently to his ears a slight creak, as of a tree bending in wind. With one hand he held her wrist, the bundle of bedclothes under his arm. With the other, he beat off the clinging, filmy spiderwebs that came thick onto his lips and eyes. He walked to the third floor and into a room that had a window opening to a narrow air shaft. It stank of old timber. He circled the spot of the flashlight. The floor was carpeted with black dirt, and he saw two bricks lying in corners. He looked at Bessie. Her hands covered her face, and he could see the damp of tears on her black fingers. He dropped the bundle of bedclothes.
Unroll 'em and spread 'em out.
She obeyed. He placed the two pillows near the window, so that when he lay down, the window would be just above his head. He was so cold that his teeth chattered. Bessie stood by a wall, leaning against it, crying.
Take it easy, he said.